Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser here on Blog Talk Radio. I am so excited about the program that we have this evening. But first, as I usually do for all those people who tune in or who will be listening and a pre-recorded copy if you've missed the live session today, I want to give you some of the numbers and the exact address so that you can tell people to tune in. Remember that we also do a video afterwards, the after show afterthoughts, and that appears on Godly Entertainment on Facebook as well as in the YouTube. And when you go to YouTube, it's the Lenny Godfrey channel. And please, please, when you do, subscribe there and let me know that you've seen it and make some comments. Now, you are listening to Lenny Godfrey, Straight No Chaser. If you have friends or if you want to dial in, it's 516-453-6063. And it's on blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. This evening, I am going to have a conversation with a very special person that I met a couple of years ago through my husband's best friend, Kwame Salter, who has appeared on this radio program. And Joy Colelli is probably one of the special people in the world. I met her when she came to a program that I did at the Hudson Theater, and I directed it, called Unentitled by Charles White. And she exclaimed at that point that she wanted to do something with the group Essence of Acting that I am artistic director with. Now, Joy has been in the education management department career for many, many years. She's currently a consultant in higher education and enrollment management. And we're going to talk a whole lot about what all of us are going to get an education about that. But she has also been servicing 5 different universities over 30 years. And it's Polytech University in Brooklyn, NYU, Mercy College, Mount Sinai School of Medicine, Metropolitan College of New York City. I mean, these are absolutely wonderful institutions that she has worked in. I know that she is a product of Madison, Wisconsin, the Madison campus, UW Madison campus, because my husband and Kwame and she were all there together at the same time. So it is my pleasure, and that's just a little bit of what we have to talk about with her, for she can explain far more what she does than I can. And she will talk to you about how the arts has influenced her career all this time. I'm really excited about this conversation. I really want to say hello, hello, hello to my Joy Colelli. Hello, Joy.
Hello, Lenny. Thank you for that beautiful introduction, and it's just such an honor to be here. So thank you for inviting me to be here tonight.
Oh, you are absolutely welcome. I am so glad to have you here because it's so important. There are so many aspects of our lives that come into play. And with this program, even though I talk a lot about the arts and how it influences us, the arts have done a whole lot in influencing people in corporate positions, people who have backgrounds in the arts when they were younger, and then they go into corporate, and how they govern themselves in those corporate positions is influenced by the arts. So that's what I want to talk about. But first, I want to talk about, I keep on hearing a little click. Are you okay? Do you hear that click?
Yes. Yeah, I hear the click too, but I don't think it's coming from my end.
Okay. I'm not doing anything, but okay. All right. We'll just see if we still hear that. Okay, good. I want to start with, where were you born, and tell me about your parents and your family and how the influence of arts ran all the way through your family.
Well, that's a nice memory lane question. Thank you. I was born in Brooklyn and to an Italian-American family. My parents were born here, but my grandparents were born in Italy. And it was a very close-knit Italian family, and as they were back then, you know, before the society became as mobile as it is today. So I lived in the house with it was in my grandmother's house, and around the corner were aunts and uncles and lots of cousins. So it was a small community of Italian Americans living actually in the middle of a non-Italian neighborhood, which we can go into later, but which had a lot to do with shaping my political awareness in society. But we were not, as many immigrants, we were low income, but I think we all felt very rich in our culture. As I had mentioned to you earlier, opera was on the radio every Sunday afternoon. My dad was in a barbershop quartet as a young man. So singing, and my dad was also an artist. He had an art teacher, and that came about because he had to stop going to school when he was 13 to work. And his father got him a job delivering paintings for an artist in the village, and in exchange for art lessons, actually. And he worked for her, you know, doing the backgrounds of the canvases and then the foregrounds of the canvases for more than 10 years. And that was his sole job from the age of 13 to the age of 22, 23. So, art is just very much a part of our life. And it's very much a part of the Italian culture. You know, some cultures want their sons to be lawyers, others want their sons to be engineers. Italians want their sons to be priests or artists, and their daughters singers. So, you know, we were always encouraged to sing and dance. Everyone was looking for the next, you know, Caruso, you know, hidden, tucked away in some dark corner until they could be, discovered. So music and art was very, very important to me as a young person.
Tell me, what part of Italy did your family immigrate from?
No, we're Southerners. Grandfathers came from Calabria, and both grandmothers came from Naples. Naples is known for being the cooks of Italy, and my family was my grandparents, all the people in my family are tremendous cooks. So I've eaten very well my entire life. I have a great palate, well-developed palate. And then, of course, when immigrants came from Italy to the United States, you know, they came in groups of their town. So the paisan, the definition of paisano is someone from your town, who most likely is a cousin or a distant cousin. So, you know, there were paisanos that came to the house to pay respect to my grandmother, who were from Calabria or from Naples, the atmosphere which I grew up with was even with non-family members, was very, very Italian.
Now, explain to the audience, if you could. I told them a little bit about how we met. You came to a performance of Unentitled at the Hudson Guild Theater. You came with Kwame and his family. And you immediately thought that this was the kind of message that we were talking about in that play, and in, and ultimately in the play that we'll talk about that you actually did bring to the Metropolitan College of New York City, was something that you thought you wanted to be involved in. Tell us, at this point, you were in, you were at the Metropolitan College of New York. Tell us tell the audience what you did and the impact that the work had on you, if you could, please.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, I started there as a consultant in enrollment management. And when you hire a consultant for enrollment management, you're really asking someone, an expert, to come in and find out what the problem is with enrollment. Many, many private colleges are tuition dependent. So their budgets come from enrollment, tuition, and if the enrollment is down or down with new students, or you have students attriting, you know, leaving the school through attrition, they will oftentimes bring in someone like myself to examine it and see, you know, where things can be improved. And by the time you and I met, I was asked to take on the interim vice president position of enrollment management, which meant for this particular college, it meant that I was responsible for all of the new students, admissions, and marketing, but also all of the services that continuing students needed, such as Bursar, financial aid, the registrar's office, disability services, student services, and advising. So the idea is, you know, you bring in an expert who has worked in these various departments with documented success, and we can help, it literally can help turn a college around financially. So that's, you know, my job is to help a college get out of financial trouble through improvement in their enrollment. And for those schools like Polytech or NYU that don't have an enrollment problem, the job is to shape the community of new students to meet more of the direction that the university wants to go into, in terms of perhaps in the case of Polytech, looking for innovative inventions, you know, creating a community of students that were inventive-oriented, who had already established research credentials in high school, to begin to shape a new type of student community that was going to be a part of a lot of inventions and, you know, that kind of thing. So I hope that makes sense, but that's what I was hired to do. And at MCNY, Metropolitan College of New York, it was really to help the school turn around financially. At the same time, your audience might be interested in knowing that for the last 5 years, colleges have struggled, particularly the elite schools, have struggled with the concept of diversity because, you know, it took them a while to realize that just having access to a college by students of color is not sufficient. You know, once the students of color need to get there, if they get into a hostile environment where faculty do not appreciate the unique differences in cultural perspectives or in a student's cultural background, then it becomes difficult for a student to be successful. A student of color to be successful in an elite white institution. So colleges for the last 5 years have really done the best they could to examine themselves and bring race awareness and a race consciousness, and actually referred to as structural, to eliminate structural racism and sexism that's in the universities, as well as the unconscious bias of faculty members. And, you know, we see that unconscious bias in faculty members starting at the most common denominator among students, which is students that have some type of disability, some type of physical or emotional disability that requires, an accommodation in classroom, whether it be a note taker or, you know, a space for their wheelchair, redesign of bathrooms so wheelchairs can get into bathrooms. Students who need, who are blind, who have the right to an education, and so colleges have struggled with this probably since the ADA, the Americans with Disability Act, in 73 was first passed, colleges have had difficulty with really providing accommodations to students. But they've worked through it. And so when the issue of unconscious bias and structural racism came to the forefront, they began to see that as another avenue of growth for the elite schools, and spent a lot of time and a lot of money hiring people who were going to examine their curriculum, examine their texts, sit in on classes, listen to students' complaints about how teachers will treat a student of color differently than a white student in class, and just in terms of answering their questions. So when I saw the play Unentitled, I thought this was a great opportunity to bring to the forefront another perspective on what it's like being black and middle class in the United States, particularly in Long Island. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, I guess. I immediately saw this as an opportunity. The schools struggle too much, and it's too academic when they attempt to route out structural racism and unconscious bias. It's the same old thing. You've got talking heads talking down to students, talking down to faculty. Nobody wants to be called racist, but everybody wants to solve the problem. And, I'm in high school, I was a Latin student, and which means that I read all of the Greek tragedies, Sophocles and Euripides and Aristophanes, and I was always raised with the idea that plays were the ultimate communicator of social reform, and that certainly is how Aristophanes wrote his plays, and in the bards of in England, and how when they would travel from town to town to sing, they were really communicating social reform and informing the politicians of how the populace was reacting to them. So I saw the play Unentitled, and of course Greenwood, as a phenomena of educating people gently but profoundly.
Well, thank you very much. That did explain how we met, the impact that it had on you. Now I want to just kind of go, maybe I want to hit just a little bit, there's something that we were talking about off air before we got on air. And you were talking about, you found in the last couple of years that many family members have come to you to talk to their young people about their choices of colleges. And one of the things that I want my audience to hear is how important that is, that education does happen, because many of them may not have children who are about to go to college, but may have someone in their family. Can you tell me what it is that you tell those young people at this point in time when they have questions about choosing colleges?
Yeah. So, the first thing I do, if at all possible, I try to get the student to sit with me alone. Sometimes it's so informal that, the parents and their child will come over to my house, and then it's a little hard to separate them. But I first want to find out from the student whether or not they have undue pressure being placed on them by their parents or their teachers at school to go to a specific school they don't want to go to, or to go into a specific field that they don't want to go into. Because I could be very helpful with that for that student in that situation, as I have been, in my job as a VP in enrollment management. Sometimes a student was eligible, qualified to come to school, but it was clear in our interview with the student that they didn't really want to be an engineer, but they were just doing it because their father was an engineer and that was expected of them. And so we were always very helpful in explaining to parents why the child was rejected, and we would and help the parent understand, determine what the parent's concerns were, which is usually career options and salary, and we would show how the job that the student is selecting, the career path that they're selecting, would in fact get them a very good job, and what those salary ranges are and where they would work and that kind of thing. So the first thing I would do with a student is try to ascertain whether or not the question is really the parent's question and not the child's question. But if in fact is both the parents and the students are at a quandary and they don't really know how to make the decision, then we sit and like we talk about colleges in general, what they have to offer, what they look like, what they feel like, how you determine whether or not a college feels right to you. You like big classrooms and small classrooms. You like a lot of attention, a little bit of attention. You want to be in a lot of clubs. Is that not important to you? You're looking to do research in a lab. You want to work with one faculty member, or you really don't know, and you want to be able to go to college and just explore all kinds of majors. So I do what I would call goal clarification on how the student feels about school. And the kinds of courses that they find very easy and the ones that they are enamored with but find challenging. And then
wow.
We just talk about – a lot of times students will have a list of schools. And those schools are oftentimes popular as a result of gossip that they've heard online, over the years. A school is heard to be a party school, or a school is heard to be, the best football team or the best basketball team. And I'd say, well, do you want to be a basketball player? You want to be a football player? Well, okay, maybe just because it's such a great football school, maybe that's not necessarily the right school for you. So you want to figure out what it is that the students are looking for in their college experience, and you want to match that with what their career goals are, because there are a lot of students who have very clear expectations of a college degree. And I need to show them that an expectation is the result of the end of a journey, and that they have to plot and plan that journey, and they have to do that well. And so if you want to be someone who, if they see themselves traveling internationally, then going to a small little private college that does not have an international network is not the right choice for them. And even though that small little private college is cute, or has a good team, or it has some friends that go there, now we have an issue to really iron out, because their expectations won't be met by the school that they're looking at. There are those students who come in with very high grades and very high SATs, and they've picked a school that they think is great, and I have to explain to them, look, that their ranking is over 300. And, you have the grades to get into a school that's ranked, in the top 50 universities in the country. And then I explain to them in detail which companies, what the career service placements look like at elite schools and schools that are in the top 50. What kinds of internships they get, what kind of schools, jobs that those schools offer their students. And then students they're hearing stuff that they've never heard before. College advisors in high school don't have this information, and college advisors in college aren't going to talk to potential applicants. They're trying to help their current students. So just to give you a brief example, I've had students...
You fill a void. There's a void that happens. Now, see, what's interesting to me is I'm working backwards. Okay, so now you have this wonderful vocation where you are helping students, and I wish I had spoken to somebody like you when I was getting ready to go to college, because, you make some choices based on some very commercial reasons and recommendations, and it, because of that I had to change. And I have enjoyed both of the colleges that I went to, Hampton University and Hunter College, but had I spoken to someone like you, I would have known which goal oriented place would have been really right for me. But now, taking you back, so now we know what it is that you do. I'm going to take you back now to Wisconsin, Madison campus.
Yes.
Activism. Did some of the activism that you had there, because you were very active in a lot of the movements that were on campus, and this campus had, 55,000 students or something like that?
Yes. 58,000 students.
58,000, and I think maybe 200 of them were black. There was a close-knit unity of people who knew one another, and your activism had you involved with that. Did that have anything to do with your how you came to be an enrollment manager. You know,
Tell me how, why? Well, I went to college to, my dream at the time was to be an underwater archaeologist. And my degree, my bachelor's is in anthropology with a specialization in archaeology. And, but the movement on campus, and I think, you know, you know, as I have mentioned to you earlier before we were on the radio, that my dad and my mom's political activism, we didn't call it political act time. We called it the right thing to do. But their activism, it was really ingrained in me. You know, I watched it. I witnessed it. I was on the sidelines. I helped it whenever I, you know, was allowed to. So my dad was a union organizer in the 50s, you know, he'd come home beaten up. He was on strike for a year. So, you know, you begin to feel, without any confusion, how important your dad's work is because the family was making sacrifices for it. And, so that was always in, you know, always a part of my personal fabric. So I loved my field of archaeology. I love archaeology and I love the field, but it just seemed irrelevant when, you know, the United Farm Workers were being beaten like my dad was being beaten, you know. But this was the 60s and the 70s, and I thought that was, you know, I thought that was taken care of when it became legal to organize, you know, to form a union. So, you know, I was awakening to the fact that the world, when not looking, the world goes back to behaving badly. So I was elected to the student government as a student senator and appointed to a vice president of academic affairs for the student government. With a fancy title, my job was to collect exams from tough professors and have an inventory of previous exams that students could come and take a look at to help them study for their, you know, for their exams. But in my role, the African American Center and the Native American Cultural Center were being shut down. And so Kwame used to call the WSA, the Wisconsin Student Association, the White Student Association. But we did, in fact, create a coalition of student organizations that were led by the African American Cultural Center and led by Kwame, called the Ethnic Science Society, an Open Centers Committee. And we met every day and strategized on ways of keeping these two cultural centers open. And when it looked like that wasn't happening, we occupied for the entire fall semester in 1974. We occupied both cultural centers, the African American Cultural Center and the Native American Cultural Center. And then we had negotiated a ceasefire, you know, so that actually we negotiated that so that we could all go home for Christmas because the end of the semester was coming up and we had to go home, so we didn't want to leave the cultural center. So the state agreed, the university agreed. Kwame had gotten a woman by the name of Lori Wynn, who was African-American, the first African-American woman elected to the National Education Association for the state of Wisconsin. And she was a firebrand. She was a firebrand of a person, and she was the lead negotiator. And when we got her, the university administration really perked up and took us seriously. And then the entire spring semester was devoted to trying to figure out a solution. And, you know, they gave the Native American Cultural Center to the Women's Studies group of people, which, of course, was, you know, a divisive tactic to pit one group against the other. So, you know, I was watching all of this. And at the same time that this was going on, there was an anti-war movement going on and support for the United Farm Workers. So we were also organizing, the Wisconsin Student Association organized a strike against the Student Memorial Union so that it lost 50,000 a month in where students did not come in to have lunch or breakfast or dinner for the entire fall semester and spring semester of that year. And so there was a lot going on. I think I was so immersed in it. And then after I graduated, I stayed in Madison and continued working as a community organizer for the community of color, which was minuscule. It was less than 1% in Madison. But they had created this Bayview Housing Project, which was originally called in the Italian neighborhood. Back in the early 50s, it was torn down in the urban renewal efforts that took place in the United States. So this entire Italian community was completely razed, and the land laid vacant for 10 years, and then a group of people came together, created a nonprofit organization, one of three in the country, were nonprofit but a housing project, and they needed a community center, and somehow I got to be the director of that community center, wrote lots of grants, got it lots of money, enough to sustain itself, and manage that. And so I think my path at that point was just well established that I was going to somehow be involved in politics. Kwame ran for public office. I was his campaign manager for 3 years until he was elected to the Board of Education, and then he ran for mayor. He didn't win that, but he did win every election for the Board of Education every year thereafter, every three-year term, for three terms without a penny spent in advertising on his behalf. And I ran for public office as well. I ran for a city council. So I think my career was well established as going to be involved in being a change agent in society. But when I left Wisconsin to return home to New York, I got a job as an admissions counselor while I was on my way to trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life, and that job just led to a 40-year career. And I found myself really able to provide access to colleges for students of color, change policies on what I considered to be restrictive policies that precluded students of color getting into the schools they wanted to get into, making sure they got the financial aid that they deserved, that they were eligible for, creating an atmosphere of customer service where the racism in the school systems in the 80s was just rampant from my point of view. And I was on the inside looking out, right? I mean, Italians back in the 50s, were not always considered white. I was a light-skinned Italian, but I had a lot of dark-skinned Italians in my family, and I saw how racism affected them. They were called derogatory terms. My dad, as a young man, was called the N-word. My older brother was called the S-word, if you recall what that is, for Puerto Ricans in New York, because they were so dark-skinned. So I was, but I passed, if you know what I mean by that, Lenny. So I was in the rooms where people talked about how they weren't going to make sure, they were going to make sure that not all of these students were going to get into school. And so I felt that what I did in the Madison campus, so I could continue that work in the back rooms of the higher education. And to that end, I feel I've been very successful.
Well,
long way to go, but I feel, that I was devoted to that goal, and I'm proud of the work that I did.
Well, you should be. My journey, I'm going backwards with you because I can see where you are now. And what I want the audience to see is how you got there. So we are now in Wisconsin, but let's go back when you were more at home. And you talked about, there's several things that you talked about. You talked about, You took musical instruments, didn't you? Didn't you take lessons of some kind?
Yes. I was a piano player, and I was in the band. I played the E flat mellophone, which is a kindred to the French horn. It has the fingering of a trumpet, and it looks like a French horn and sounds like a French horn. And so I was in a marching band, and I used to play for assemblies at school on the piano. And my dad got very sick when I was still in grammar school, and so I had to stop piano lessons. And just to share with you how important music was with the family, when I was a piano student, I had to practice an hour a day, every day, and I took lessons for perhaps 4 years. And then when I had to stop lessons because we couldn't afford them any longer, I was still expected to practice the piano an hour every day, and I did.
Well, let me ask you, because, you know, I mean, I always say that the arts, that our involvement in the arts in a lot of different ways, the discipline that you just talked about of practice, whether you are taking lessons or not, if you had your druthers, all right, and I know that the influence on your father, a union organizer, and your mother being involved in so many programs, because your mother supported him and she volunteered at the girls as a Girl Scout leader and in the women's chapter of the Sons of Italy Anti-Defamation League. But if you had a choice,
mm-hmm.
now you went into the field that you were, what if you had a choice in the arts, what do you think your choice might be if you were an arts major?
If I was an arts major, my choice would be oil painting in portrait and
mm-hmm.
singing. Singing would have also been there, yes.
Okay. So as I try to, you know, what I'm trying to do is connect how the arts really influenced your life, you know, through and still do, because your passion for wanting to people to understand the connection of the arts of realism to the make-believe of theater, but how it can really lead our society in so many ways, that passion is still there. Did you go to the theater a lot when you were younger?
No, I didn't. We were really too poor to do that. So I only did that in my later life. When I returned to New York, my dad had passed away. I needed to figure out a way to spend social time with my mother and not have a fight with her. So we got season 6 to Lincoln Center for both the Avery Fisher Hall at the time and the Metropolitan Opera House. So, and theater, going to plays, was never really something that I did a lot of, although I love plays, but I think I was more, again, attached to music, symphonies,
music.
And opera,
mm-hmm.
so my
mm-hmm.
time was taken up with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I think that having art work in the house, watching my father paint, my father expecting us to do watercolors or acrylic and teaching us how to do certain things artistically, you know, that it just seemed that was the purpose, that was one of the main purposes of life. If you couldn't, that a good life, you couldn't have considered yourself having a good life, was not involved with it. It's the, you know, art is the beauty in life. And so, you know, what's the purpose? Our banquets of meals are pageants of beauty. You know, I mean, it's all about that piece of life, that emotion of how to manifest love, I guess, is what I'm saying, is
yes.
art. To me,
yeah.
is the manifestation of love.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by the fact that people do so many different things, but when I look back into their lives, how much the arts are there at the very beginning of their lives, and how it, you know, how different their lives might have been if those things that you really loved about the arts were not there. And that's the whole point of this. Now, you're going to kill me. I usually say, well, we've got a half an hour left. No, we have less than 20 minutes left now. and I want to open it up just in case anyone wants to ask any questions. I want to open it up so that, you know, they can call in and ask questions now. But I do have a couple other kind of queries that I have for myself. I want to know, I know you talked about one of the most wonderful moments was when your mother graduated college at the age of, 72? 76. And, you know, that was a really high point. What other high point in your career did you have?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of high points in my career. I'll give you one small example. I'll give you two examples. One example is I was trying to build up the computer science department at the Polytech, and which is the second oldest engineering school in the United States. It was responsible. The school, its faculty or its alumni were responsible for most of the major inventions of the 20th century, the third rail in the subway, New York City subway system, the traffic system in the subway system, the suspension part of the Brooklyn Bridge came out of the civil engineering department at Poly. The alum from Poly were able to take penicillin out of the test tube and put it into the distribution mode of the pills and the vaccination. Plastic came out of Polytech. So, you know, it was a great, great school, and I wanted to build up its computer science and cybersecurity department. And we created a contest that first started out just on a local level, but blew up into a regional, statewide, then regional, and then national, and then international level, a cybersecurity contest that high school students could participate in, as well as college students could participate in it. And there was this young woman who was a freshman at her high school, and she kind of fell into this computer contest that I had talked about. I went and actually, in my process of recruiting good students for the school, I talked about the cybersecurity competition to a lot of teachers and a lot of schools to get them to participate in to serve as mentors for their computer science club or to start a club. And this young woman, just by chance contest, her team made it to the finals that year. And then the following year, and they won. They won like third place. The following year, she went down ready to sign up for the competition again. And the boys in the team wouldn't let her sign up. They didn't want the girl. And so she formed her own team, made the finals, and came in second place. And students
wow.
who, there was a lot of money. There was a lot of money associated with this competition. To date now, we have 25,000 high school students around the world who participate in the cybersecurity competition. But she won each year, you know, in her junior year as well. She won the competition. She pretty much had a full ride to Polytech, and by that time it had already merged with NYU. So imagine getting a four-year full scholarship to NYU.
Wow.
Because she won these security competitions. And she taught for Poly she taught the cybersecurity competition to teachers. She served as a liaison for our high school, and she's now a top cybersecurity person at Chase Manhattan Bank. So, you know, it's a great story to see how students sometimes accidentally fall into something and they do well in it. Women particularly do well in cybersecurity. No one really understands quite why, but they seem to excel in cybersecurity where they may not excel in other aspects of computer science. And I was very proud of that. And the other thing I want to tell you, Lenny, is I was very proud of bringing Greenwood to the Metropolitan College. It was the first time in New York City that it was being publicly presented in a stage presentation. It had a powerful influence on all of the students that were there and on the faculty, and it helped put the school on the map, and it helped make the school reaffirm its mission. So it was really a great project.
Well, thank you. And people should know that Metropolitan, Metropolitan College in New York City is a private college that is populated with students of color.
Yes,
and
it is a designated black institution. So it's which is the modern day version of the historically black colleges and universities. So they're it's called a PBI, predominantly black institution, even though it's not, you know, there's it's a diverse student population. But when colleges have that designation, it's not just that the majority of students are black or Hispanic, but that, that there's a corresponding faculty, corresponding administration, corresponding executive leadership is also black. So it's a really great school.
All right. Now, we do have a question. So they're coming up. Okay. I have to go to the question now because we have less than 15 minutes left. So, all right. Thank you very much for calling Lenny Gaffey Straight No Chaser. Welcome. Tell me your name and where you're from.
My name is Michelle, and I'm located in Houston, Texas. Thank you so much for participating this evening. It's been very insightful and interesting. My question is, why do you think that the arts are not fully appreciated in the United States compared to some place like the UK or Italy?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll tell you my viewpoint on that is that it's almost too easy, that there are too many people in the arts who are they didn't have to take a test or go to school for it. And then the other part of the arts is too hard. So you either can never get into it, you know, so you're never going to be an actor or actress or be successful in that field. And then the other piece of art, because a lot of bands in high school are in, you know, aren't that good, the choir isn't that good. And so people fail to realize how much self-confidence, self-esteem that the arts actually bring to students. And of course, the schools are really inundated with a curriculum that in part is more than they can handle. We have five times the amount of information in biology and chemistry and physics today than we did in the 50s and the 60s. So the courses that students are learning, the computer science that students learn, it takes so much more attention academically that they feel they have to cut certain things. And because more students are driving cars, all of a sudden driver's ed is part of the curriculum, when it shouldn't have been. You know, my dad taught me how to drive. So, you know, we shouldn't have to, the school should not have to take over all new types of knowledge and convey it. But because so much of the knowledge they need to convey is so much more complicated and complex, those things that are that seem to be disposable, like art, like singing, like dancing, are off, unfortunately. That's my take on it.
I agree. Thank you very much for this question, Michelle, and don't go away because I agree very much with Joy, and I think that one of the things that you brought up is that there is no there's no requirement and there's no testing to get into the arts. Whereas I think the respect and I don't know about Italy, and I think that's why she was asking you about Italy specifically and their education system, is that here in America anyone can decide that they want to be an artist, and they're really, you know, outside of the school system, and there really isn't any requirement, no qualifications for it, and people don't take us as seriously. So, you know, that's the disadvantage that we have here also, unfortunately. Michelle, do you have any other questions?
No, but I appreciate all the stories, and it's really just very interesting. I think your life has been interesting, and I'm happy that you've been an advocate. So thank you very much.
Thank you for saying that, Michelle. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Michelle, for calling in.
Mm-hmm.
So, Joy, I think what happens in our system, and the reason why I am so adamant about continuing this conversation, and it is a conversation, and I try to get people from all walks of life, it's so that people understand that even though there are a lot of there's a lot of content in a lot of other subjects, that art is not disposable. It really, you know, it's not a disposable entity, that if the influence of art had not happened on so many other people, the aspects of what art brings to our lives is what really makes us the people that we turn into. The discipline of learning piano early or an instrument early can really turn up in a person who becomes a scientist that might have discovered penicillin or anything like that, because of the simple fact that that person really learned early on that you have to stick with it and you have to be able to be persistent and consistent and all of those things. And art does that. And I don't think too many other things in life do those things like art does. And I don't think that it's appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Let me share this with you. It is known now that the neurotransmitters that are built in your brain that you, that everyone begins to build when they learn something new. So every new language that we learn, right, new neurotransmitters are being developed in our brain for us to manage this new information that we're bringing in. The mm-hmm. neurotransmitters that get built in your brain when you learn music are the same structure as what you learn when you learn mathematics. And so so that if a student does have a strong music background where they read music, they understand, you know, they understand the half notes and whole full notes and how to count, and they will be building neurotransmitters that they will be able to use when they learn trigonometry and geometry. So, and people know this, but scientists know this and educators know this, but it's never been used in an explanation as to why we need to have music or why we need to have art. But after 9/11, there was a sculpture made in on the East Village. It was off of 3rd Avenue, and it was a bronze sculpture that was a person upside down, attached to a wall of a building about 3 feet from the sidewalk. And it was clearly in honor of what happened in 9/11. Here was a dramatic sculpture showing everybody what it mm-hmm. was like, those people who jumped out of the building. And it created such an emotional reaction from the entire community in the East Village, that the artist was forced to remove it after it was up for about 2 weeks. And I saw it. It stopped me dead in my tracks. It was the thing about 9/11 that broke my heart more than anything else. And I could not stop looking at this sculpture. And it helped me deal with my grief about 9/11. And, you know, to this day, there's who were not directly affected. You know, no one I knew personally died when the towers collapsed. I had friends who worked in the towers who played hooky that day. But I was not directly affected. I didn't directly lose someone that I loved in the buildings. And yet there are so many people but I was so affected by 9/11. And that sculpture is something that's clear in my mind to this day, you know, 20 years later, was so powerful. And I think that that's what art does. I think all art does that in society, but people haven't been taught to understand the value of exposing your emotions and crying and, you know, and healing through your tears.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, it's just like a lot of subjects that in Europe, our own sensuality, our bodies and everything, it's really much more relaxing, and the cavalierness of it is far more relaxed in Europe than it is here. We're still quite prudent about this, even though we can go vulgar with it, but just everyday being relaxed about it, that's, you know, being vulgar is not being relaxed. It's just showcasing yourself, but just making it a part of our daily lives. We just have not had the opportunity to really interject that and integrate that into our society. And now I have to tell you that we are down to the last 4 minutes of this show. I told you it was going to go fast. See that?
Yes, you were right.
Yes. And Is there anything in these last few minutes that you would like to say about what you would want the education or the art system to be 10 years from now?
Well, yes. For me, education is the ticket out of the ghetto. I felt that I grew up in a ghetto. And that ghetto was not as much a physical environment as much as it was a mental construct of, you know, I was the first woman in my family to go to college, the first woman to leave my leave a father's house not married. So, you know, for me, that was my ghetto, right? I couldn't be myself. And to me, education was the ticket out. And so firmly believe that every student should go to college. That college is just the way grammar school and high school is for everybody. College needs can be for everybody as well, and that schools will in fact embrace that concept as more and more knowledge is being given to us, as more and more people demand a democratization of college life. I think more people will be expected to go into college, graduate, and use that degree. And so, in 10 years. I see a transformation in colleges, I hope for, that is fully appreciative of the diversity of race, of gender, of sex, of ethnicity, of perspective, that colleges will flourish when you have not only STEM but STEAM, right? Science,
yes.
Technology, engineering, art, and math.
Exactly.
And that the technology that we have in the world today, the remote learning, that is really going to play a very major role in making colleges more democratized and more available and accessible to students.
Well, I hope that it's a wonderful vision. I hope that also in that vision we accept the fact that what people's concept of college is, it doesn't apply to everyone, that college then starts to appeal, get a larger appeal so that people don't think that they have to be a certain kind of person with a certain kind of economic background or social background to go to that next step. And the colleges take on a whole different characterization and commercialization and appearances that satisfies a larger group of people than just the small group of people that it does now. With that being said, I'm going to have to say that we're almost down to a minute, and I'm going to say thank you so very much, Joy, for coming in and talking to me this wonderful hour, that we're going to continue our conversation on video at the After Show Afterthoughts that will be on Godly Entertainment and Facebook. And if you subscribe, please go to Lenny Godfrey's channel on YouTube, and we're going to do that. We're going to take a little break, and then you and I will resume. So I want to thank you so very much. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening, for people calling in. Thank you again. I will be seeing you all on September 8th with a wonderful, wonderful show. It's a roundtable of the dancing queens, I call them. So I thank you so very much. And with that, I'll leave you with a little tune that you'll see on my promo, which will be See You in September. All right, and thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser.
This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever.
When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me,